Welcome to Limitless, the Blind Beginnings podcast where we discuss tips, tricks, and current topics related to all things in the blind and partially sighted community. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce the founder of Blind Beginnings and your host, Sean Marcellet, and whatever co-host is on this week. Now, here's your host, Sean.
Welcome back to Limitless, the Blind Beginnings podcast. I'm your host, Sean Marcellet, and I'm so pleased to have joining me as my co-host today, Ginny. Welcome back, Ginny.
Hello.
And today's guest is actually a very special person, Betty Noble. And Betty is the president or the chair of the Blind Beginnings board and has been for several years. And we thought this would be an awesome opportunity for our listeners to get to know the Blind Beginnings leader. So welcome, Betty.
Well, I don't know if I'm the Blind Beginnings leader. I think that's who you are, but I try to help out for sure.
Awesome. So why don't you start by telling our listeners, well, first of all, I always like to ask people about their vision. So,
right.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Okay. Well, I'm totally blind. When I was born very early, prematurely, and I was only 2 pounds, 8 ounces. And I don't know how that translates into metric, but it's not much more than a kilo. And so I was put in an incubator with oxygen going into the incubator. And the incubator is sort of like a, looks like a glass box, really, with a funnel at one end where the oxygen was coming in. And of course, to keep the newborn baby warm and stuff like that. So I was put in one of those and the oxygen destroyed my retinas, I guess, basically. I'm not sure how long I was in the incubator, but probably quite a long time, couple of months at least. And so the interesting thing is that with my sister, who is low vision, she was born 8.5 months after I was, and they had thought that maybe the oxygen was doing a bit of damage. So they left the incubator door open for her. So she has some vision. So it's too bad I wasn't born last, but hey, that's the way it goes.
I mean, this is like a little off topic, but my math is not working out there. You have a sister that was born 8.5 months after you.
Yeah, that's right. My mom had 5 premature babies. And the biggest one was my brother, who was 5 pounds. And my sister, the firstborn, she was born in 1940, and they kept her warm on an open oven. They didn't have, you know, the whiz-bang technology they had in the 50s that they thought was really helpful and ended up, you know, damaging people's eyes. Mm. So she was born in 1940, and her vision's absolutely fine, but she was lucky to have survived. So, yeah. And I feel very lucky that I survived too, because that's really little.
No kidding. Well, we're also very happy you survived. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious where you grew up. Did you go to a regular school? Did you go to school for the blind? Tell us a bit about that.
Well, my first memories are of living in Hope. It's about 100 miles from Vancouver, and we lived in this kind of, I don't know what you'd call it. Shack maybe isn't the right kind of word, but it wasn't a very big house. And it was right on Silver Creek. And there were 4 of us in our family. And I can remember playing with chickens out in the backyard. And for some reason, I was the only person that could pick up the chicken. And so whenever kids came to visit, they always asked me if I would go get a chicken so they could pet it. And so I felt pretty popular, actually. I was around, I think, 4. And I remember loving to go on the swings. We had a wooden swing. And one of my mom's memories is once I went outside on my own, and I used to really like the sound of the creek because it made quite a loud water sound, almost like a waterfall in a way. But one time I got so close that I was standing right on the edge of the creek, and she thought, oh my goodness, if she takes another step, she's going to fall in the creek and drown. So she said she remembered going out, and she didn't want to run. She didn't want to call out to me. And so she just kept walking and walking and walking. And finally she found me and said, "You have to step back. You're right at the edge of the creek," because I didn't have a cane. I wasn't using a cane at that point.
Right.
So that's an interesting memory.
When did you start using a cane?
Well, I was 16 years old when I started using a cane. Yeah. Eventually we moved from Hope because when we still lived in Hope, I went to Jericho Hill School for the Blind, and I had to be a student who lived right in the residence there, right in the dorm. And I hated it. My parents hated it. I used to get a ride home about one weekend a month with another family. And my mom said, by the time I got home, I was often running a fever because I was so excited to be home.
Wow.
And so they decided when I was in grade two, my dad got a transfer. He was working with BC Hydro, and he got a transfer down to Vancouver so that I could live at home. So then I went on the Easter Seal bus to school all the time. But in those days, kids didn't use canes. And I used to walk, along my street and shoreline with my foot. So my one foot would be on the grass and one foot would be on the sidewalk. And I used to roller skate. And I'm trying to remember how I used to find out where our house was. But I think there was a hedge that was right before my house that was a really great landmark. And when I knew that, I guess by echolocation or whatever, that I was close to that hedge, then I knew that our house was the house next door. And actually, too, my sister, who had some sight, we would often go sighted guide together. And it was really kind of cool that she was in the neighborhood, because she helped me get introduced to all kinds of kids. And I just played with the neighborhood kids. I can remember having someone hold on to the baseball bat with me, and we would hit the ball, and then we would, grab hands and run the bases together. And I did, playing Chinese skip and regular skipping, when there's a really long skipping rope and you stand in the middle, like there's two kids, one at either end, and you stand in the middle and you skip. And I used to skip like that. And we used to play this really crazy game. I don't know if kids play it anymore, but it was called Chinese skip. And there were two long elastics, and you had to twist your ankle into one, and then you had to hop and put one foot over the other elastic that was sort of beside the one that you were twisted with. And
like a skip at.
Yeah, different kinds of things you had to do with that. And I can even remember playing hopscotch, but then of course I always hopped on the line because I could never get in the square properly. And then the kids would all argue about whether I was out or not. And then they'd usually give me at least one more chance. So that was kind of cool, actually.
Wow. That sounds so much different than what it is now. So you mentioned that you went to Jericho.
Yes.
Can you tell us more about that, because nowadays, we're integrated into mainstream education. Was it different going to the school for the blind? Did you have the same social experience?
Well, the difference was, for me, I was lucky because I was socializing with the neighborhood kids when I was at home. And so I got the best of both worlds. But when I was going to school, I was with all children who were blind, and there were, small classes. I think there were around 11 kids in my class. And, we socialized quite normally, but I don't know. It was nice to be with kids that were the same as I was. We kind of competed academically that way. And we were quite mean, though, to kids that had come from homes where the kids were overprotected a little bit. And, we weren't very patient with those kids when they didn't want to walk by themselves, or when they couldn't find things in the classroom that we could find easily, or we used to have to read out loud a lot, and some kids were better at reading than other kids. And I don't know, it was It was an okay experience, but I think I would have probably, I like the idea of being with, you know, blind children some of the time and interacting with people you can feel comfortable with and let your hair down with, but you have to live in the sighted world. So I think it's important to be in a regular school and to learn at a very early age how to adapt and, you know, figure out how you can do things.
So you then went on to university. Was that really challenging after being kind of all your schooling, being in an environment where everything was accommodated?
Well, actually, I left the School for the Blind at the end of grade 10. So I went to a regular high school in grade 11 and 12. Okay. And that was a huge adjustment because at the School for the Blind, there were like 120 kids. And the school that I went to, Killarney, there were like 3,000 kids in grades 8 to 12. And knowing some of the neighborhood kids was a huge help because I actually knew some kids. And that was when I decided, or somebody decided, maybe my mom talked to CNIB, and then it was decided that maybe I better learn to use a cane.
Right.
But I was pretty cagey at going sighted guide a lot with people I knew at the school. And they arranged a kind of buddy system to help me get from class to class. So I had like a person in each class that would walk with me to the next class. And while that wasn't great for my independence, it was fabulous for socializing with the kids. And some of those kids that were buddies became friends. Some of them didn't. And some of them I thought maybe were friends, and then I would hear them talking in the washroom about, oh, I got to take Betty to socials, and then I would feel really horrible, right? So,
yeah,
you know, it's all a big learning experience. But when I went to university, that was when I really had to use a cane a lot because I didn't have friends that were going to the same classes as I was. Although I did room with my cousin, which my mom thought would be, you know, helpful in the transition. But my cousin was a nursing student and she was taking all sciences. So, you know, I had to go from class to class on my own. And I discovered that that was not such a bad thing, because if I got lost, I would just have to ask a passerby. And sometimes those passerbys were guys. And I thought that was a great thing.
So, I mean, when I started university, I luckily, thankfully, as I lost the ability to read print, there was technology right there to give me some audio options to do my work. So I just can't even imagine, like, how, you know, were you carting around a Perkins Brailler with you from class to class? How were you taking notes? How did you do it?
I took I used a slate and stylus, and I was really fast with it. And I had a portable typewriter that I would type my essays on for my professors, but I couldn't edit anything. So it had to be reasonably okay right from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, forget it. And sometimes I did have a Perkins. So sometimes I would write stuff out in Braille first and then copy it on the typewriter. But often I didn't, because I was too lazy and I would leave things to the last minute and stuff like that. So I would mostly use a typewriter. And then when I was in third year, I got some fabulous advice about writing an essay, and it was to write ideas down on cards and then organize them, the cards, before I started to write. And I think that really helped me with my writing, because I don't think it was all that great before I learned to do that. So that was really helpful. But yeah, you had to, the Crane Library was there, and that was wonderful. That they were really good there, and I used to get books on cassette tape. And there, in those days, CNIB transcribers that were local would transcribe books into Braille. So when I was taking languages, my French books and German books were in Braille. And that's great for languages, because really, if you're listening, you don't know how to spell things. So I really needed Braille for that. The only downside was that they often couldn't keep up, and the books weren't ready before the term started. So sometimes I wouldn't get the complete book until a couple of weeks before the final exam. And so that was crazy.
Yeah.
That I feel like that still happens sometimes.
It does.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just shaking my head at the thought of like having to write an essay and not being able to kind of stop think for a second, like what was the last word I wrote, or what how did I say that sentence again? Like just having to pretty much go from beginning to end and not look back at what you wrote. Like, wow.
It was pretty crazy. And I'll never forget the time we were having a pizza party, and it was about, I don't know, 2 a.m. or something. And I was so happy. I was almost finished this 10-page essay. And then I had sort of the stack of pages beside me. And then a friend who was, I think she was a roommate, maybe. I think that was Gage Towers, maybe. Anyway, she had a look at the pages and she said, "There's nothing on this paper."
Oh no.
That's so awful.
And it was something called stencil. And I had somehow knocked, I had a plate of pizza, I guess, on the top of my typewriter when I wasn't typing. And I had kind of knocked this lever to go into stencil and I didn't realize it. And so I was happily typing and only like the marks kind of, I don't exactly understand how stencil worked. Mm. But anyway, I had to start the essay all over again.
Oh man. Oh,
that is so awful.
When I was in university, I used to joke about that was kind of like my backup. If I didn't get an essay done, my excuse in my back pocket was going to be, "What do you mean there's no print? I guess my printer must be out of ink."
Yeah.
And in a stack of blank papers and, you know, pretend you think it's your essay that's completed.
Well, I almost had to do that.
Yeah. Wow. So what did you do after university?
Well, let's see, I finished the first 4 years and then felt that a BA really didn't, wasn't going to give me a lot of options for work, but I really wanted to work. So I went to the CNIB and I had these manual dexterity tests where I had to put round circles in circular holes and square things in square holes and stuff, I guess, because they wanted the job they were thinking about, you needed to use your hands a lot. And they knew I had a brain, but they weren't sure I could work with my hands, I guess. It was kind of demeaning, but whatever, you know, you had to do what you had to do. Mm. And I ended up getting a job at a photographic studio developing place called Mortifee Munshaw. It was downtown on Davy Street. Richard Street. Yeah. Richard Street, Richards and Davy. And so what I did was I worked in the dark room, in the dark, splicing films together. So putting films onto a big reel, and then we would put them into a light proof square tin and take them out to the developer. And then the developer would do the developing, and then they'd go on to mounting and printing, and eventually people would get their photographs. So there were other blind people that were working in that area, and it was a job at least. I remember it paid $3.15 an hour. But I thought that was a lot of money at the time. I had done some singing when I was in university, but made some money a little bit doing that. And I'd also worked in the language lab helping people with their French pronunciation at university to get a little bit of extra money as well. But I hadn't really had like a 9-to-5 kind of job, and I really thought I needed to do this. And the really good side about this job was that one of the guys who worked as a developer developing the film became my husband, and we've been married for 45 Aww. years. So that's where I met Dawn. So it wasn't such a bad thing, right?
Yeah.
That's I quite enjoyed it, and you know, sometimes in the summertime we would, you know, we'd wear bathing suits under our clothes. And when it got hot in the dark room, we would just take the like skirt and top off and wear our bathing suits. But once in a while, we'd forget that we weren't properly dressed, and we'd go out to give them a lightproof tin full of film. And then we go, oh my gosh, I forgot, you know, it's light out, everybody can see us, you know. You have to go racing back to the dark room, but it's kind of funny. But so I'll tell the story. I was moving in with some new roommates, and both Dawn and I were on graveyard shift because they had shifts at this place. And so I was late for this one shift, and we had to punch a time clock. And so I got there, I was supposed to be there at midnight, and I got there at about 12:30 because I was just, we were just kind of finishing unpacking for the move or whatever. I don't even remember now why I was late, but I was late. And Dawn came in, and he said he had punched me in on time, on the time clock, so I wouldn't lose any money. Aww. So when he came into the dark room and told me that, I gave him a big hug. And, oh, thank you. And so the way he tells the story, he says, I attacked him in the dark room. But I honestly just gave him a hug. And that sort of started off our relationship. Aww. But then after about a year, I guess I should tell you too, I started there in August, and in the following January, that was August 1973, and then the following January there was a strike, and so we had to picket, and during the strike time there was about 2 weeks when I decided not to picket, and I went to Hawaii with my sister. And so, of course, when I came back, I was all tanned, and Dawn started teasing me, but nothing ever really got going until that hug in the dark room. So we went back to work in May, and then the following September, I decided to quit Mortifee Munshaw and did a diploma in adult education. Okay. Because I thought maybe I would teach adults. So I did that diploma, and during that time, Dawn and I got married, and our first son was born. And then I had a daughter, and then I was teaching French at Langara College, just to have, you know, a way to get out of the house and some work to do. Then I decided that I would do a teaching degree so that I could get a teacher's certificate, so that I could teach kids or adults. And I thought then that would sort of broaden the job market for me. So when my kids were fairly little, I was going back to university and getting this. It was a one-year teaching degree. And I did a practicum in at the school I used to attend at Killarney. I did two practicums there. I was teaching French, actually. And then I did one up in Williams Lake. And I enjoyed it, but I found that I had trouble distinguishing the voices. Voices in high school sounded almost all the same to me. And at that time, I did also have a hearing impairment. That happened when I was around 15. I went in the swimming pool, and I was doing a lot of swimming underwater. And I don't know, something weird happened, some kind of virus, and I lost a lot of the hearing in my left ear. So while I enjoyed the practicums and I passed them, I wasn't sure how well I would do as a high school teacher. But I applied for different positions, and the interviews were really frustrating because they kept figuring there were things that I couldn't do. And, you know, instead of asking me about what I could do and how I would handle certain situations, they would just say, well, you know, what would you do if there was a fire, and how are you going to correct the kids' work? And you know, it was a constant stream of questions about what they thought I couldn't do. And so I knew right from the minute I walked into the interview that they weren't even considering hiring me, even though I had, you know, figured out a lot of coping strategies, and I did have to pay a marker And you know, that was frustrating, but you know, there was really no other way to do it, but I could create all my own transparencies, and I put masking tape on the blackboard, and if I really, really needed to, I could write on the board, but I would usually get one of the brighter kids to write something up on the board because I knew it would be more legible than whatever I would write, because I'd never really learned to print very much. So I don't think my writing was, printing was all that legible. But anyhow, yeah, so I did this teaching certificate, and I'm really glad I did, because while I started my career in the end teaching at a community college, towards the end of my career, I taught kids who were blind or visually impaired in the school system. And if I hadn't had that teaching certificate, I wouldn't have been able to do that.
Yeah.
So it worked out to be a good plan in the end.
So being a teacher for people or children who are blind or partially sighted, did you find that it was a different experience for you with the kids because you were also blind?
When I was younger, I completely resisted that. In fact, my French teacher said to me, "Oh, you'd be great teaching French to blind people." And I said, "No way. I want to teach French to people who can see." And I did do that at Langara. I didn't do it in high school except during my practicums, but at least I did do it at Langara. But that was absolutely the thing I did not want to do. However, life is funny and it takes interesting turns. And when I had finished that teaching degree, I went to, CNIB was helping people find employment at the time. So I went to see Marianne Roscoe. And just at that time, there was a program for the deaf and hard of hearing at VCC. And they had a deaf blind person there. And so they hired me to teach the deaf blind person math and Braille. And, you know, I kind of went, well, I don't know sign language. I don't know how to communicate with a deaf blind person. And the person interviewing me said, "That's okay, he'll teach you." And he did. He actually did teach me the two-hand manual alphabet. And that's what we used for communication. And then after I just worked part-time afternoons for a couple of hours, 3 days a week. And then at the end of that year, towards the end of June, I thought, well, you know, there really should be a program for people who are blind, not just for people who are deaf, so that people who have lost vision, who need to learn blindness skills, maybe should have that advantage as well. And so I went up to see the administrator of the college at that time and said, you know, you really need to start a program for people who are blind or partially sighted, especially people with vision loss. And at that time they had money and they actually made the decision to do that. And so they hired someone else to sort of be the department head for the program. And they had just started having vision teachers, and she was a vision teacher. And so she headed up the program for the first 4 years. And so it was just a learning experience along the way. And the thing that really made that program work was that in 1984, they got computers. Think the program started in 1981, and at that point we didn't have any computers, so we were just teaching Braille. Because they taught English and math in the program for the deaf and hard of hearing, we thought we should do the same thing. And then we developed a course in what we called assertiveness skills, because we thought that adults needed to learn to self-advocate if they were going to go on to do regular programs at the college. So we did that, as well as English and math and Braille. And then computer courses came into being, and I interviewed for the coordinator position and got that. And the lady who had been the coordinator was really upset that I actually got the job over her, so she actually left. Oh, wow. She was sighted.
Yeah.
It was kind of interesting, but she was a great person, but I maybe she just felt like that she would have that position forever, and it just didn't work out that way. So then I you know, took on leadership of that program, and I just stayed there. I was enjoying doing what I was doing, and I saw so many people that had life-changing experiences, and I felt that for blind people to interact with other blind people was also very useful, because they realized that, you know, other people were going on to other programs and becoming very successful and finding work. And so even though I was sure that I wasn't going to do anything like that with my life, that's what I ended up doing.
I just wanted to ask about that, because I think a lot of us maybe feel that way. I didn't plan to work with people who are blind either. And I'm just curious, you know, I think for me, I felt like it wasn't a real job or something. It didn't count.
Yeah.
If you couldn't make it in the sighted world, or if you couldn't get a job, you know, where non-blind people work. But I'm curious where that came from for you, Betty.
Yeah.
Well, I had the same feelings, to be honest, but I had worked at Mortifee Munshaw. I had done some professional singing. During my college career, I actually was seconded to work for the provincial government and to manage projects called Skills Now projects, which were projects that post-secondary institutions were doing to work with students with disabilities. So I managed to sneak out of working with blind people a couple of times. but I valued that work. I learned to value, because I could be a role model. I could really encourage people. What really made it worthwhile for me was seeing people. Maybe they came to my office for the first time. They didn't use a cane very well. They didn't think they could do anything with their lives. And, you know, people like that became, you know, one guy I remember became a computer programmer, and he married and he had a family, and he had a full-time job with ICBC. And, you know, similar experiences with other people. So I could help other people gain the confidence and skills to go out into the world and become, you know, really productive members of society, and to realize their dreams of, again, working, or, you know, even if they didn't have the dream to be working and you know, leading a quote normal unquote life, maybe they just wanted to be able to interact comfortably in their community. Whatever their goals were, if I had a part in helping those people achieve those goals, then for me, it's been totally worth it.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's this stigma maybe amongst the blind community of, you know, if you're working for the blind community, you're not, it's not, it doesn't count or something. But absolutely,
yeah, I would say.
I think for me, definitely also working, being who better, right? Somebody who's lived it, who can totally relate to what people are going through,
and
be an example that yes, you can.
Yes.
It's very rewarding for sure.
And I mean, I didn't live in an institution or anything. I had a family, a husband and children, and I raised kids, and you know, so I did all those things that everybody else does. I just happened to be working with blind people, and you know, I didn't mind doing it after a while. When I first took the job, I was a little skeptical, but there was a challenge of learning to work with a deafblind person. And frankly, I needed to make money. So if this was going to be a job, and I could, you know, help support my family, then, you know, that's what I was going to do.
Yeah, because there's still a high unemployment rate for people who are blind. I can only imagine, you know, in the 70s, 80s, what that, you know, while you were growing up too, like, was there an expectation that you would work and support yourself?
Well, my parents always expected that I would. And no one else in my family actually went to university except me out of the four children.
Wow.
And I had wonderful parents. I was so fortunate to have parents who were willing to allow me to take risks. They were willing to allow me to make my own mistakes and learn from them. That was so important, so valuable. My mom used to say, when I was learning to make cookies and stuff like that, she's saying, I can't watch you, but if you need me, I'll be in the living room. Call me. Because she knew that I had to figure out ways to do things myself, that, you know, the way she did things as a person with vision maybe wouldn't be the same way that I did things, although she always encouraged me, like, you know, to make sure I took any rings off and stuff, and to make sure my hands were always clean, but to mix dough with my hands instead of a fork, you know, and things like that, so that I could make sure I got all of it, you know, mixed up. Mm-hmm. Even if I used a fork, I would still, you know, use my hands for stuff. And, you know, there was a lot of humor in my family too, you know, so, you know, if I didn't want to eat something, Mom would say, eat your carrots, they'll help you see in the dark, and, you know,
yes,
goofy stuff like that. And I remember one time I made a meatloaf, and I think I mustn't have used my hands at that point. And I must have decided to break it with a fork. And it was wrapped up in some very thin paper, and I didn't realize it. And so there were bits of paper all throughout this meatloaf. And so it got cooked and everything. And she took all the paper out of mine, and I was eating it and going, oh man, this is delicious. And I could hear all these giggles around the table. And I was trying to figure, what's everybody laughing about? So then Mom told me, she said, yeah, you cooked a bunch of paper in with the meatloaf, but I took yours out. And we all just had a big, you know, good laugh over it, right? Aww. I mean, I was embarrassed about it, but it was still funny, right?
Totally.
And yeah, so they had humor. And I, one experience that my mom had when we were both in a baby buggy, when my sister and I were really quite little, she was walking with us along the street, and a lady came by, you know, as people do, to admire the babies. And you do have to remember, this is like probably 1953. And the lady was saying how, you know, how cute the babies looked. And then she was kind of looking a bit closer. Well, what's wrong with their eyes? And Mom said, well, my younger daughter has a little bit of vision, but my older daughter is blind. And she looked at my mom and she said, oh, they'd be better off dead. And she walked away. And Mom said from that time on, she determined that her children were going, that she was going to do everything she could to make sure her children were as successful and happy, normal adults as they could possibly be. Because she was so angry with the attitude of that woman, and that we were going to, you know, change society's attitude to blindness.
That's so cool. I mean, that attitude.
No, but it is. Yeah. Well, the way my mom reacted to it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And she did have someone, a social worker, who would come to visit her when we lived in Hope, and probably not so much in Vancouver, but when we were babies. And that really helped her a lot to know how to work with a blind baby. Like, my brother taught me to walk. He was about 9. But when I started walking, I walked backwards, I guess because nothing was encouraging me to walk forwards, right? And so, you know, it was just little things like that that she would get help with. And she helped me train my memory. You know, she would say, oh, we have to go shopping for groceries, and I want you to remember what I need. And so she'd say, I need milk. And then a few minutes later, she said, oh, I need bread too. What else did I need? And I'd say milk and bread, you know, that game where,
And
I would have to remember all those things. And then when we would go to the store, she'd say, okay, what do I need to buy? And she would also, like, when she took something off the shelf, before she put it in the cart, she would show it to me. And
I love that.
And she would say, you know,
your mom is so amazing.
This is a loaf of bread, and this is a pound of butter. Well, she had advice to do that. And that's the kind of thing that Sean does with parents. And it was the kind of thing that Arlene Scott did when she worked for CNIB. And she was a huge help to my mom in helping her, you know about different things to do. The only major mistake I feel my mom made, which irritated me my whole life and still does, to some degree is that because my sister had some vision and because we were close in age, even though I was the oldest, she would say to my younger sister, look after your sister because you have some sight.
I can relate with that.
And oh man, I hated that. And my sister to this day still feels like she should be responsible for me. But you know what? She did so many other things very well. And I know she was well-intentioned. I mean, because we went everywhere together in the neighborhood, all over the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I would go sighted guide with my sister a lot. And, you know, I mean, she was from July 15th to November 1st, we're the same age. So, right. You know, we were very close. And I do understand, you know, even though I still not sure it was the right advice, I do understand what she meant.
Yeah, you can overlook it because of all the greatness.
Exactly.
So, yeah. After you retired from the college, it's so funny, I feel like you've retired many times.
I have, actually.
You did work as a vision teacher.
Yes, I did. And
I'm just curious if there were some needs that you saw amongst the children you worked with and the families that are still not being addressed.
Absolutely. I felt that there wasn't enough social interaction. The kids mm-hmm. would often go to the skills classrooms where there were other kids with disabilities and have lunch, for example. They concentrated so much on the academic curriculum that the kids often didn't have the time or I don't know exactly how to explain this, but I felt like kids needed to spend more time with their peers. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, that was challenging and they didn't, because it's just as important to develop social skills as academic skills. And, you know, sometimes kids just either because they often didn't want to, because they didn't have friends that they hung out with after school. Mm-hmm. They couldn't, even though they were learning O&M, even with a parent, you know, walking behind and watching, they couldn't go, you know, to a friend's house. You know, like I used to walk alone sometimes to other places in the neighborhood. Now, granted, in the 60s, there wasn't nearly as much automobile traffic. Mm-hmm. But I did this sometimes without a cane.
Yeah.
And so I guess peer interaction with the kids other than just at the classroom level, like I really felt like some students didn't have friends that they just could hang out with.
Did they teach social skills at the School for the Blind, or do you think just being exposed to kids that are willing to connect with you, you learn them naturally when
that's
you're blind?
That's right. I think you just learn them naturally in a social mm-hmm. situation. They certainly did talk about things like holding your head up and not, you know, putting your fingers in your eyes and, you know, like weird stuff that blind kids sometimes do that isn't appropriate in social situations. And sometimes they would talk about how sighted people use their hands making mm-hmm. gestures when they speak. And because we can't see other people doing that, we tend not to do it. And so we look a bit wooden and stiff. Or if I was walking down the hall thinking about something and I, you know, forget to smile, you know, someone would say, "You're scowling." Mm-hmm. And you know, then I would learn that I, you know, I didn't have a happy facial expression. Because maybe I was concentrating. So yes. Some of those things were definitely talked about. But I think the advantages I had having a younger sister who brought other children into our home. And so I naturally socialized with other kids. And I, you know, I learned to bounce a ball and, you know, do things, play the same games that other kids were playing as much as I possibly could. It helped me because I was included, and it helped them because they learned how they could include me.
Yeah.
And I felt that, children that were severely had severe disabilities weren't always getting the opportunities to learn to use communication devices to be able to communicate with other people. I think a lot of assumptions were made about low cognitive ability, which maybe wasn't necessarily the mm-hmm. case. Mm-hmm. And so that I found challenging too. Like, rather than speaking to the person, sometimes people would speak about the person when they were in yeah. the room as if the person wasn't there. Mm-hmm. And even with people that have, you know, very significant disabilities, I feel like you have to remember that they're people and that you should talk to them as if they can understand, because you don't know if they can or can't, if they're nonverbal.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think, you know, I remember having a student who said she wanted to just go for a run out in the field after school, and the parents said, you know, no, you can't do that. Or things that parents and others felt might be risky behavior, they didn't allow the student to do. And so the student couldn't gain confidence. And of course, there's all kinds of, you know, there are liability issues and things that get in the way as well. And so it's a challenging situation. But as much as possible, I think, you know, kids should learn to be independent and, you know, do things like pick out their own clothes. And, you know, so if you wear odd socks to school that don't match, well, then somebody will tell you that.
And I think that's even in style nowadays.
I was going to say that's a new trend.
Yes, I know. I know from my granddaughter, because she never seems to wear socks that match.
Must be a nightmare to fold her pairs together later.
Yeah. Well, actually, in a way, it's easier because you don't have to find a match. So you right. just find two socks that look roughly the same and you just put them together, right? And there have been times when I've done her laundry and I just haven't ever worried about it. Yeah, it's funny.
So having the experiences that you had and your mom's, you know, passion to make sure that you were quite successful and seeing the needs of blind children and families, is that what attracted you to be a part of quite a few boards and organizations?
Yes, actually, I always want to make a difference and do something, anything I can to help other people do what they want to do, to meet their goals. And it was 1981, I moved into a co-op, and that was a whole new kind of housing at the time. And the people in the co-op kind of were supposed to run their own affairs. And that was my first experience being on a board, but it wasn't quite. I was on the board of CNIB in the 70s, but I left the board because I felt like I wasn't doing anything useful. I was just rubber stamping decisions that had already been made at the time. So I didn't stay on their board very long. But when I had an opportunity to be on the board of a housing co-op, I thought, oh, this sounds interesting. And so I learned a lot of skills, like chairing meetings and helping people gain consensus and making decisions as a group of people and supporting each other and just learning about what it was like to be on a volunteer board. And so that kind of piqued my interest. And then in 1997, Fred Poon, who used to work at PRCVI, the Provincial Resource Center for the Visually Impaired, he asked me if I wanted to be on the board of Braille Literacy Canada. And he was on their board and he was leaving their board. And I guess they were asking board members to recruit other people. And so I said, yeah, sure, I wouldn't mind doing that. And then CNIB asked me if I would be on their board, and it just kind of mushroomed from there. And I've been on several different boards. And when I was at the college, doing my administrative work, I was on committees and when I was at the college also, I left the program for 4 years to work as the division chair of adult basic education. And so in that job, I worked with all of the different programs in the division. And I had to approve professional development leave and all kinds of different things. So there were different times when I wasn't in the classroom and I wasn't administering the program for the visually impaired. So there were those 4 years that I worked as an administrator at the college, and then the 1 year when I worked for the provincial government on those disability projects. So I did work part of my time not working with blind people, but primarily in my career, I've worked with adults or children who were blind or visually impaired.
What attracted you to the Board of Blind Beginnings?
Well, I think Marilyn kind of twisted my arm. That was part of it. And part of it was I knew how important my mom's influence was in my life and the decisions that she made in my life to allow me to take risks, allow me to fail. She taught me to treat people with graciousness when they ask stupid questions about blindness. Just her whole attitude to blindness, I thought, if I can in any way help other parents to be like my mom, that's something that I should try to do. And if I can give anything to Blind Beginnings, any advice that I've learned through my long experience of blindness, if I can help in any way, then that's what I want to do.
So what are your hopes then with all that for the organization during your leadership with us?
Well, I think we have come quite a ways, but I don't know whether it's just because the organization was going to go there anyway or whether I had a part in it. But I'd really like to see us do more skills training for people so that people that don't have the opportunity when they're at home to live on their own. Like, I had to learn by trial and error. And I was lucky that I had sighted roommates and that I had parents that let me cook when I was living at home and let me pour hot water into a mug and, you know, do all the normal things that a kid would do at home. But I think often young adults and children don't have the opportunity to develop those skills because their parents are too afraid to let them do that. And so I'd like to see us have a lot of skills training, whether that's if we have our own house or if it's just that we have venues where we can teach kids to do stuff like we already do. I mean, we do that at camp. We do that when we've had our junior explorers things. And I think a lot of kids don't get the chance to go out into their community. So I think community discovery is really important. The hikes that we're doing now, because a lot of blind people don't get enough exercise. So the exercising stuff that we're doing right now, I think is really cool. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I had any advice to give parents, I would just say, you know, let your kid be a kid and let them socialize with other people. Even if some of those experience socializing are hurtful, it's how you learn. And it's how you learn to deal with the sighted world, because your parents aren't going to be with you forever. And you're going to have to know how to interact with people who have vision and know how to manage in a world where a lot of expectations will be placed on you and should be placed on you. You know, people should think that you're going to make it and that you are going to work and that you are going to have kids if that's what you want to do, and that you are capable of having successful relationships. All of those things are just so important in order for kids to gain confidence in themselves. And because my mom and dad believed in me and believed that, you know, I was going to accomplish great things, well, then I believed in myself as well.
Yes, such great advice.
Perfect.
I feel like I could talk to you forever, Betty. You are So I've known you for so long, and all of the many of these stories are new to me, but you know, we have to, we can't go on and on, but I did want to ask, now that you've retired again, what, like, yes, for the third or fourth time, what are your plans? What's next for you?
Well, that's a tough one, actually. Probably my plan is just to serve on some volunteer boards and continue to do the things that I do, and hopefully help those organizations move forward and accomplish what they want to accomplish for other people. I tend to get involved in organizations that, like, I'm chairing my choir board right now. I'm chairing the Blind Beginnings board. It's just things that I really believe in. I'm on the AMI board. It's enough to keep me busy. And so that's probably all I'm going to do for the moment. I love doing stuff with my grandchildren too. And I haven't really figured out what I'm going to do now that I'm retired for real.
Yeah. For real.
Other than the things that I'm continuing to do, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, good. I hope that you're going to finally get some well-deserved rest and fun. And, you know, you've done your work. I mean, don't leave Blind Beginnings, but.
I won't. But, you know, I was thinking about going on a cruise, and now I'm thinking, I don't know, too much danger of getting COVID. So probably a cruise isn't in my future anymore.
Right. But,
I do enjoy traveling. I love reading. I've joined a couple of book clubs, and that's fun. And I really enjoy doing that. And I'd like to maybe do more exercising, but my health hasn't allowed me to do that recently. So I'm hoping if my health improves, then I might be able to do like more workouts and stuff like that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. That was awesome.
Yeah,
and I think
thank you.
Gives our listeners
very welcome.
A great idea of who you are and what you're all about and the experience that you bring to the world, but specifically also to Blind Beginnings. So thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. You know what? It was a real joy to talk about different things with both of you. And I just know that Blind Beginnings is going to become bigger and better. And because of Blind Beginnings, I think parents and kids are going to be able to do much more even than I've been able to do so far in my life. And it's just all about confidence and the willingness to take risks.
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
This has been Betty Noble, our president, helping us make Blind Beginnings better, bolder, and bigger.
And brighter.
You got it. You got it.
I like adding in a couple things.
Thanks again, Betty, for joining us. And
You're welcome.
You, Ginny, for being my co-host today.
Anytime.
You've been listening to Limitless, the Blind Beginnings podcast. I'm your host, Sean Marcellet. Please join us next week.
For more information on Blind Beginnings and its mission to inspire and support children and youth who are blind or partially sighted and their families, visit www.blindbeginnings.ca.